Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTDHD. I'm Gregory Berg. I remember with great fondness a past interview which I did with an author by the name of S.C. Gwynn. He and I spoke about a really marvelous book of his called Empire of the Summer Moon, Quanah Parker and the Rise and Fall of the Comanches, the Most Powerful Indian Tribe in American History. When I saw that S.C. Gwynn had written something else that I had the opportunity to interview him, I was very, very excited. But then quite surprised to see what this newest book was titled. His newest book is called The Perfect Pass, American Genius and the Reinvention of Football. So a book nothing like that first book with which I first encountered Mr. Gwynn. This book, however, turns out to be quite interesting, every bit as interesting as that first book, especially if you are interested in the game of football and wonder how certain aspects of football have risen and fallen in prominence over the years, and in particular, the place of the forward pass, which once upon a time was all but unheard of in the playing of football. And now it is, in a sense, a staple of the game, but not always so. It turns out that one of the unsung heroes when it comes to the forward pass rising in prominence in football is a coach by the name of Hal Mumme. And this is a story about him and about the really difficult road that a lot of football coaches face, far more difficult than most of us ever realize. And it's also about what it means to be a visionary with a game as often tradition-bound as football can be. Once again, the name of this book is The Perfect Pass, American Genius and the Reinvention of Football, published by Scribner, and its author, S.C. Gwynn. S.C. Gwynn, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, it's great to be with you again.
I'm glad we can do this. Tell us a little bit about your own connection to the game of football and what that has to do with the writing of this book.
Well, I'm just a good old-fashioned fan. You know, I was my hero when I was a kid was Johnny Unitas and Baltimore Colts. And, when I moved to Austin, Texas 20 years ago, I just totally got into the Big 12 conference and I'm not one of these completely kind of crazy fans, who flies into different cities to do the fantasy draft and things like that. But I'm pretty much just a fan. And the book came from I went out to do an article about a coach named Mike Leach for Texas Tech back in 2009, who had the hottest offense in America. His quarterbacks had led the NCAA 5 times out of 6 years or something, and nobody could stop this offense. And I just asked him where it came from, and he said, I got to tell you a story about this coach named Hal Mumme in a little tiny school called Iowa Wesleyan back in the 1980s, and that turned out to have actually transformed the game of football.
Hmm. And you say in the kind of the acknowledgement section of the book that as you learned about this coach that nobody had heard of named Hal Mumme, that one of the best things about his intriguing story was its very obscurity. I mean, here is this great story just waiting to be told by somebody like you.
True, and even today, you know, I mean, how many people really have heard of Hal Mumme? Inside the football world, coaches, commentators, former players, he is pretty well known. But to the average rank-and-file football fan, he's not. And, you know, if you go back to there he is at this school in Iowa in 1989, a school with 450 students, you know, possibly the worst football team in America when he takes it over. You know, absolutely, it's complete obscurity. And so when he and his assistant coach Mike Leach are driving around in the off season through the frozen wastes of the Midwest looking, you know, going to see people and looking for the secret of the forward pass, I just thought, that just sounds like a great story.
And I don't remember where it is in the book, but at one point you characterize Hal Mumme as a genius who irreverently destroyed and recreated the game of football. And that's a really interesting way to think about it, about somebody coming along and, in a sense, destroying the game, not permanently or right. irreparably, of course. But what is behind that choice of words?
So if you look at this, okay, it's a game of football, and okay, it's offense that we're talking about here. But in fact, it's, you know, it's the product of all sorts of systems and ways of thinking about things. And you can really think of Hal, I do anyway, in the same way that you might think of one of those innovators like, or some of those innovators like Jobs and Wozniak, you know, inventing the Apple computer, or Hewlett and Packard, or people tinkering and being innovative and ingenious with, and indeed what they then do, their creations then do create enormous disruptive damage to traditional systems. You know, if you look at what Hal's offense has done to football today, I mean, you turn on the TV and you're going to see some quarterback throwing the ball 49 times a game for 500 yards and five touchdowns. That's his offense. That didn't exist when he started. So he wreaked havoc on defenses all over the country, and he did it by doing things that no one had done before.
Hmm. So describe to our listeners where the book begins. I think it's quite effective. The first chapter is called The Mad Pirate's Revenge, and
right.
it's kind of interesting the way in which you just sort of plunge us into the new reality of football before then, in a sense, kind of explaining where this reality came from. So describe the dramatic game that is at the heart of this chapter.
Okay, so the book starts with 1 minute and 23 seconds to go in November of 2008. And the game being played is Texas Tech, which is sixth ranked, and had never been ranked that high before, or not recently anyway, and against University of Texas, number one ranked team, the best quarterback in the country at that point, Colt McCoy. And what I then describe is this incredible air raid offense that, you know, people were starting to get used to, but it had only seen for a few years. That has this ability to, you know, throw the ball 50 or 60 times and put up ungodly numbers of points and yardage on everybody, and no one could stop it. Well, we see this in action in the last minute of the game. And the final, and it's a very famous pass if you live in Texas, the final pass of the game is from Graham Harrell to Michael Crabtree, a 30-yard pass and tiptoes into the end zone for the victory. And what I try to set up, as you say, is I try to set up, well, here's what this thing looks like. And then we sort of, and indeed, this is now swept through all levels of American football, high school, college in particular, NFL more and more. So I just go back to its origins and say, where did this guy get this idea? How did he implement this system? What was the process actually of transformation? How do you do that?
Hmm. I think it's very intriguing, and I'm really glad that the second chapter of the book is here, titled A Job You Wouldn't Want. And you begin this chapter by saying, in the annals of the American workplace, there are few jobs as thankless, unforgiving, underpaid, overworked, lacking in security, destructive to marriages, and mercilessly competitive as coaching college football. Yes, there is the warm glow that comes from making an impact on the lives of impressionable young athletes, teaching them the virtues of courage, discipline, teamwork, etc. But for the dewy-eyed idealists and everyone else, the more immediate reality is this. And you go on to describe in really rather brutal detail all of the ways in which this kind of work can be really kind of soul-crushing. I'm so glad that's there because, you know, it flies in the face of what we sometimes hear about, which is of big schools paying their football coaches gigantic sums of money that dwarf the money paid to, for instance, professors at that same university. But that is just one little sliver of the picture. And what you are describing, of course, is the unhappy reality for the vast majority of college football coaches out there. Tell us more about why you think that is such an important point to make in this book.
Well, it is. I mean, it's a tough sport. It's a tough job, you know, and it's high school coaching is really football coaching is a really tough job too, except it lacks this one thing, which is the 24/7, 365 need to recruit all the time. And high schools generally don't do that. They basically take whoever lives in their district into their games. But college coaches, you know, the minute the game ends or the season ends, they're on a bus or a plane somewhere to go recruit, and sitting in the living rooms of countless players and guidance counselors and parents, and trying to convince people to come. It's a hard job. It's also thankless because, as we all know, when the head coach gets fired, what happens to the assistant coaches? They all get fired. And I found myself in this world of, you know, people who often had 12 jobs in 20 years or even more, and it was tough. People moved around a lot, and when you look at someone like Mike Leach, who's now head coach at Washington State, you look at the hardship of those early years when he made $3,000 a year lived in these miserable, broken-down trailers. It is a very hard job to do, and so Hal, in my description of him, he's not only up against all of tradition of football, trying to build this offense that does mostly passes the ball in a world that only wants to run the ball, but he's also got to deal with just life as a coach, which involves he gets fired, he gets run out of town. It's a tough deal.
Hmm. Well, and for him, it is also a reality that involves a wife and young children. So it's not just that he is subjecting himself to this because he loves the game of football so much and so desperately wants to coach it, but in a sense, he is taking along his wife and kids on this very difficult journey.
They're on the ride, and one of the things you hear and I write about is that, you know, when the typical thing happens, which is, you know, Thanksgiving comes around and the team hasn't done well and the head coach gets fired, and then, of course, all the assistant coaches get the news that they've been fired too. And often what happens is, if somebody is able to find a new job somewhere, you know, typically the rules are you show up the next day and your family just has to worry about dealing with the problem itself, you know, or whenever anybody hires a coach, they don't really want to hear that the wife, you know, has got to sell the house or relocate the kids from school. And I just heard this from a bunch of coaches' wives. It's a very interesting world of really, I must say, really dedicated people, super, super dedicated people who run this game.
We're speaking with S.C. Gwynn, talking about his book, The Perfect Pass. And before we talk a little more about what Hal Mumme managed to develop, we should touch on the brief history of the game of football that you spell out. And I think the main reason that this is here is for us to have a better sense of sort of the entrenched reality against which this revolutionary-minded coach named Hal Mumme was going to try to work his innovative ideas. In brief, at least, just sort of describe the way in which football had a certain character right from the start, which, yeah, in a sense, was very inhospitable to the notion of throwing the ball, and particularly in terms of long forward passes.
Yeah, it goes back to the early days of football. I mean, football started with this kind of bloody scrum in the middle of the field that was just unbelievably violent. And the forward pass was introduced in 1906 mainly as a way to save the game. So many people were dying, you know, 18, 20, 30 people dying a year, 150 with serious life-threatening injuries. And so they introduced it. But the problem was that American football always wanted to regress back to that game. And to this day, it's still portions of it want to do that. So even though there were little explosions of offense, you know, Pop Warner in the Carlisle Indian School, or maybe Notre Dame with Newt Rockne a few years, Sammy Baugh at TCU, Norm Van Brocklin in the NFL, with the LA Rams. Basically, football always reverted back to a heavily ground-dominated game. It was a running game. Football was something you did. I'm sorry, throwing was something you did on third down. And if you look at it, what it finally comes to in the mid 70s is what they called the dead ball era. In 1977, in the NFL, fewer points were scored than at any time since 1942. Fewer passes thrown since the 1950s. It was regressing again, and it was so bad that the NFL changed all the blocking rules to try to save the game again. But this is the era in which this new breed of people, you know, Mouse Davis and the run and shoot, Bill Walsh and the West Coast offense, Hal Mummy, Lavelle Edwards and BYU, these really handful of people that I write about emerge from this kind of dead ball era with these hot new passing offenses.
Right. And I guess part of the point of your book is that some of these innovators are well known to football fans, but somebody like Hal Mummy is not. That is, in a sense, a chapter of this story that was largely untold until your book came along.
Yeah, and there's a lot that's untold in here. I mean, nobody's ever heard of Tiger Ellison. I mean, Tiger Ellison in the 1960s invented a type of offense at a high school in Ohio that uses a lot of the techniques that are the basis for all of the high-powered passing offenses now. And who's ever heard of Tiger Ellison? He had this crazy thing called the Lonesome Polecat. Nobody ever heard of. And yet the techniques, when I go through, you know, his offense was the run and shoot, which actually became very influential. But there's a lot of obscurity here. Very few people really know who Lavelle Edwards is. I mean, they might know his quarterbacks, Jim McMahon, Ty Detmer, Steve Young, but at BYU. But so much of this is rising out of obscurity, and even today, these guys are not household, you know, they're not like Vince Lombardi. Maybe they will be one day, but they're not now.
So in terms of what Hal Mummy came to understand about the game of football and sort of its unrealized potential, I find it really intriguing that it was not just one single moment and a lightning bolt from the sky and suddenly I understand this new way of playing the game of football. You choose to describe it in this particular chapter as a series of four different epiphanies. And yeah. And these are epiphanies that unfolded over the course of years.
Right.
And in different places and in different circumstances. Is this the way he sees it, or is this the way it made sense to you to frame it?
I don't think he ever saw it in terms of the four, although that's what it is. I mean, these came out of interviews with Hal. In fact, that's what it is. So there were four. One of them was really great, by the way. One of them, this guy is just good as a football coach. So he's the age 29, youngest offensive coordinator in the NCAA Division I. He's at University of Texas at El Paso, which is sort of the French Foreign Legion of college football. Terrible team, one of the worst in the game. They were playing against Brigham Young, BYU, who was the defending national champion, that had this super hot passing offense under Lavelle Edwards. And Hal, I think they were favored by 36 points or something like that, BYU was. Because Hal was at UTEP, who was in the same division, he got to study their film. So he studied and studied and studied, and he tried to copy it. No one told him anything. It was like somebody who found a radio on the ground. You know, you pick it up and try to figure out how it works. And during this game, he unleashes BYU's own passing. This is 1985, passing attack against them and beats them in one of the greatest upsets in college football history. And the other shoe dropping there is that BYU is so stunned that this guy has done this to them with their plays that they didn't even teach him, that they invite him up, and for years he spends time at the BYU camps and he learns their system, which becomes the basis of his system. I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, that's what we talk about when we say these epiphanies. You know, that game was an epiphany, that he could do that to the nation's best football team.
Hmm. One thing that is a little difficult to understand about this story is how there could be various people along the way, like this coach out of Ohio, Glenn Tiger Ellison, who writes a book touting some of these revolutionary notions, a book that eventually Hal Mumme reads and is inspired by, but how these innovative thinkers would appear, and yet their innovations would not, in a sense, lead sort of inevitably to this innovation sort of sweeping over the game. And he's not the only one, of course. But so there are these sort of isolated pockets. But what is different about the story of Hal Mumme from some of those other earlier instances?
I think if I had to say what, that's a really good question. Let's look at Sammy Baugh, Dutch Meyer, coach of TCU in the Texas Christian University in the 30s. He had this quarterback named Sammy Baugh, who was maybe the best player who ever lived. And they ran a full spread offense. He ran from a shotgun. They used short ball control passes the way Bill Walsh later did. I mean, it was so far ahead of its time. So you would have thought, man, everybody's going to. But the fact is, hardly anybody did it. And so what was different about Hal? So one of the things that people thought about that offense, or most of these offenses, is they wouldn't be transferable. Not, you know, they wouldn't be transportable. That they would, that somebody like Baugh couldn't be duplicated, or, you know, a receiver couldn't be duplicated. What Hal did, and this was maybe the biggest part of the revolution, was he designed an offense that could be run at the high school level easily. It was dead simple. The simplicity of the thing is most of the genius. It was just dead. So now you can see all over Texas, we're out of air raid offenses, all summer 7-on-7 air raid camps, the whole state's being swept by it. It's because you can teach it, because it's transferable. You can run it at junior colleges and small colleges, and you can run it anywhere you want to. I think if a coach reads my book and takes anything from it, I would think he would take the simplicity. This guy designed a game that was really easy and simple for his players and really complicated and hard for your players.
And it also sounds like a system in which you did not necessarily need a spectacularly gifted quarterback or spectacularly gifted receivers in order for it to be implemented. I mean, you don't have to wait for an Aaron Rodgers to come along.
Exactly, and that's the set. Right, I should have said that. That you do not need that. And what it does is it makes, if you look at that great book, Moneyball, written a few years ago, what it was about, this guy at Oakland who's got $19 million, and New York Yankees have $190 million. And the problem is, how does the little guy in Oakland beat them? That's the problem. And the solution is how he uses statistics. In this case, Hal has these little guys, and how can they beat the big, strong, fast guys? Well, they can beat it through this system, a system that will allow a small quarterback or a receiver that isn't lightning fast to compete. So when you do it right, it levels the playing field, and there's a bit of David Goliath in it, with David and Goliath, which is kind of fun.
Mm-hmm. So a closing question. As we follow the exploits of Hal Mumme, one of the things that we sort of grapple to understand is why he's not more famous than he is. Why, if he ended up being such a brilliant innovator, why, in a sense, at least in the more conventional sense of the words, has his coaching career not been more successful, leading from one triumph to another?
Really, you can see the answer to that question, I think, at Kentucky. So he lights up the world at Iowa Wesleyan at the small college level. Then he goes to Division II, Valdosta State in Georgia, lights up the world, sets all the national records in NCAA D2. He's rewarded with the head coaching job in the SEC at Kentucky, 1997. And he takes his offense, and he beats Alabama and LSU. People said you could not use these video game passing offenses to win in the SEC. Hal did. Okay, now we're at the peak of his career. Unfortunately, what happens to him is he runs into a recruiting scandal at Kentucky. Not his fault. It was one of his coaches was out making cash payments to high school coaches and very bad things. It didn't prevent Hal from having to resign in the middle of it, even though he was 100% exonerated by the NCAA, but that was a year later. And I think you could say in a lot of ways his career took a turn at that point that is maybe is the main reason why he isn't the coach of the Green Bay Packers right now or something like that. There were some other problems later on, but Kentucky was really his glory and his undoing, unfortunately for him.
Right. And, of course, we certainly get a sense through the pages of your book that the world of football, just in general, is not always particularly receptive to the ideas of a revolutionary thinker.
No, and it's also a razor-edge job, as we were talking about earlier. I mean, ask, you know, Colin Kaepernick and Les Miles about that, about how quickly things change. You know, Colin Kaepernick at the 49ers was, I mean, he was the second coming last year. Les Miles, a few years ago, was the greatest football genius in the country. They're guys that, you know, they're headed south real fast. So it's a cruel profession, I think, in addition to being, as you say, very unfriendly to people with new ideas who think they're going to throw the ball.
Right. Well, in the meantime, we get to know very much both the man and his intriguing revolutionary ideas, Hal Mumme, in this book, The Perfect Pass, American Genius, and the Reinvention of Football, published by Scribner and the author S.C. Gwynn. S.C. Gwynn, thank you so much for writing this great book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. This has been fun.
Greg, it has been fun. Thank you for such a careful read. It's great to talk to you.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and part two of the program, a look at the greatest game in the history of the NFL in just a moment. To finish out our program today, you're going to be hearing a portion of the conversation that I recorded a few years ago with best-selling author Mark Bowden. I've had the great pleasure of speaking with Mark Bowden on several different occasions about several different books. I especially enjoyed the chance to speak with him about his book called The Best Game Ever, Giants vs. Colts, 1958, and the Birth of the Modern NFL. This is a book in which Mark Bowden examines this tremendously important and exciting football game, which was telecast and which really helped propel the National Football League into the modern era. And it's never been the same since. And the stuff of legend and myth has sprung up around this great game. And Mark Bowden sort of separates fact from myth and also talks about some of the really key players who were part of this important matchup. The book is published by Grove Press, again, called The Best Game Ever. I wonder, ahead of you beginning work on this, how much did you know about this game? And what in particular drew you to it as the subject for a new book?
Well, I knew of the game. It obviously is one of the most famous in NFL history, and I grew up the latter part of my childhood in Baltimore, so I knew this team, and of course I heard a lot about this game. I was a little too young to have seen it myself, so I was always interested in it. The idea of writing this book was actually proposed to me by my publisher, Morgan Entrekin, several years ago after I had finished writing Guests of the Ayatollah. He knew that I was a football fan. I'd written a book some years ago about the Philadelphia Eagles in 1992 called Bringing the Heat. I was a football writer for a brief period in my experience as a newspaper reporter. So this was an opportunity to return both to a subject matter that interested me and also a piece of my own past.
It's intriguing to write about something which is 50 years in the past. Unlike, for instance, Guests of the Ayatollah, the Iranian hostage crisis, which is about half as many years in our past as this football game. As you sought to connect with some of the principal players, I'm using that term in a couple of different ways, of course, who were part of this game, it had to be frustrating to know that some of them were already gone.
It's true, you know, but I think roughly half of the men who played in this game are still around, and I was able to track down most of them. I was frankly surprised and delighted that so many of them were still around, and they were, you know, extremely helpful. But it is true that my work does seem to be regressing deeper and deeper into the past. And as you move further back into the past, obviously you, by necessity, have to rely more and more on documentary evidence and the record. So I get a great deal of pleasure out of researching old newspaper files and looking for artifacts like, say, the audio recording of the NBC broadcast of this football game. And it's really, it's a little bit like a treasure hunt. You go off in search of documentation for the thing that you're going to write about, and every once in a while you really strike gold.
I think I've touched on the fact that this game was nationally telecast, but you tell us, or at least imply, that absolutely nothing of this game survives in terms of any footage from that telecast.
That's right. There's no footage of the actual television broadcast, but there are a smattering of films of the game. NFL Films made a documentary 25 years ago about this game, which has some really terrific black and white footage shot on the sidelines. It was not from the television broadcast. It was from someone operating a camera on the sidelines, even though NFL Films didn't exist in 1958. And then there was, of course, what's called the coaches' film, which is NFL teams all utilize film to study their opponents and to prepare for their next football game. And so this game, like every game, was filmed from a vantage point high over the 50-yard line where you can see all of the players on the field, virtually the entire field. It's very useful for study purposes. It's nothing at all like or nearly as exciting as the footage that you watch on a television broadcast. But for coaches who are looking to study plays and formations and strategy, the coach's film is actually a more useful tool.
So how much of this game exists on film? I mean, even if it is from a kind of a distant, frustrating vantage point, as you just described, I mean, do we have all or nearly all or a substantial portion of this game on film?
The entire game is on film.
Really?
And I was very fortunate to recruit the help of Philadelphia Eagles head coach Andy Reid, who, out of the goodness of his heart and out of his own curiosity, sat with me for hours dissecting that coach's film, which is, of course, what he does for a living. And his insights into the strategies of the teams, the formations, the abilities of the players was invaluable to me and really informed my analysis of the whole game in the book.
You mentioned the fact that the radio broadcast, I think you said, over NBC also exists, and indeed that broadcast is quoted throughout the course of your book, including once in a while interesting mistakes, as sometimes occur in live broadcast.
That's right. You know, I used the radio broadcast to try to capture some of the excitement and immediacy of the game. We're all used to watching football games with commentary. It's just part of the experience. And so to have that instant explanation and reaction on a recording was invaluable to me, I think, in trying to capture the atmosphere. And yes, that does occasionally come with the mistakes that broadcasters make, having to, you know, unravel a complicated, fast-moving game very quickly.
I wanted to mention one other thing that you mentioned very much in passing in the introduction. You called this game Between the Giants. in their dark blue helmets and the single red stripe and blue wool jersey and the white numbers, and the Baltimore Colts with the horseshoe emblem on their white helmets and badly soiled whites with blue numbers and trim. You called this a colorful spectacle for those present, but for the far bigger part of its audience, the most celebrated game in football history would be remembered primarily in black and white. And I think that's so interesting because even if all we've ever seen is are still photos of this game, I've only seen photographs of this game in black and white. And it never really stopped. I never stopped to think about how I only think of this in black and white. And right. It's interesting how that changes our view of it and in some ways even heightens our sense of the drama that played out that day stretching into the evening.
It's true, and there's a reason why Hollywood filmmakers really enjoyed and exploited the shadows and light in sort of the monochrome of black and white film to make these wonderful film noir classics. And it isn't just the fact that this game was seen primarily in black and white, because black and white was the only kind of televisions around in 1958 for the most part, but the fact that the game was played late in the afternoon and spilled over into the evening, into night, and the lighting in Yankee Stadium, where night games were not as common as they are today, was not as effective as it is. If you go to a night game, football or baseball today, the whole arena is illuminated like it's noon. But back in 1958, the lights were very adequate for lighting up the field, but they didn't light up the stands. And so what that meant when you looked at this black and white picture on your television was you had a brightly illuminated field of play and a stark black backdrop, as though someone had just lowered a black curtain, which I think made the action appear all that more dramatic and memorable.
You say many of the viewers, meaning now the viewers of the telecast, just beginning to tune in, were not regular watchers of pro football, and they were seeing something starkly different than the traditional college games played on sunny autumn afternoons. This was more like mortal combat from some dark underworld. As in some medieval rite, the players on both sidelines were draped in long capes. A master cinematographer could not have lit the scene more dramatically. We're speaking with Mark Bowden about his wonderful book called The Best Game Ever, which is a look at the NFL Championship game of 1958. Just ahead of us talking specifically about the game, I want to return to the matter of your encounters with many of the principal players involved in this game, literally some of the players on the field and also others who were important participants. You tell us at one point in the book that one of the most extraordinary things about this game is that when you consider the players on the field and the coaches on the sideline and how many future members of the NFL Hall of Fame were on the field or in that stadium, it truly is a constellation of incredible greatness playing out here.
It's true. There were 17 future members of the Hall of Fame, and it was certainly the greatest assembly of talent ever in a professional football game. And what's more interesting about it, even just than the fact that all these great players and coaches and owners were there, but that the reason that so many of these players and coaches went on to the Hall of Fame is that they were really at the vanguard of the evolution of the game of pro football. So, for instance, you had as the two assistant coaches for the New York Giants, Vince Lombardi on the offense and Tom Landry coaching the defense. Well, they were young coaches then. They had yet to develop their own style. And, of course, Lombardi went off to Green Bay and created the great dynasty of the Green Bay Packers. And Landry went off to Dallas to create his own dynasty there. The reason that they went on to such heights is that they were innovators who were stretching the strategies and tactics of football in new directions. And, you know, the success that they would have later on is just testament to how innovative they were. And a lot of those the budding approaches that they were taking are visible in this game.
Hmm. You mentioned the fact that about half of these players are still alive, and many of them you were able to speak to. And that's, of course, one of the things that enriches this book immeasurably. I wonder, sometimes as people look back on events from 50 years before, the memories are clouded, or perhaps they see things very much from their own perspective and not that of others. Can you give us any general reaction to the experience of speaking with these men about this big day from so much earlier in their lives, the clarity of their recollection, and maybe the wisdom with which they were able to look at these events now?
You know, it varied greatly, and it's really interesting to see how. I mean, on the one hand, on one extreme, you had Raymond Barry, who is a very cerebral, was a very cerebral football player and coach, and who's someone who kept meticulous notes, which he prepared actually before the game, and has sort of made a study of football all of his life. He remembers this football game from 50 years ago as though he played it yesterday. And he has the advantage of all of his notes to jog his memory. And on the other extreme, you have a wonderful character like Fatso, Artie Donovan, who has been dining out on his wit and his humorous anecdotes about his days as a pro football player for a half century. And his memories of this game are rich and colorful, but are not always exactly true. You want to tell Artie's stories the way he tells them, though, just because they're so artfully and comically prepared, but you have to go back to the record to make sure that Artie remembers things exactly. Some guys, like Ordell Bracy, a really bright guy, has nevertheless misremembered certain key aspects of the game and has no doubt remembered them incorrectly for so long now that they are just, you know, they've become his memory. But the film of the game and the radio broadcast contradict him in certain key areas. So it is really interesting.
You, of course, were too late to be speaking directly to, for instance, the Colts quarterback, Johnny Unitas, who passed away several years ago. And, of course, there are a number of players who are now gone. But, of course, you also had a rich legacy of all the interviews which many of these important players did.
Right.
And over again, of course, this would be a game they would be asked about repeatedly.
Yep. And it's almost always the case when I write a book or a story about something that includes, you know, certain very famous people. If I can't have access to those people, either because they refuse to be interviewed or they've deceased, generally they're the least significant people for me to not be able to meet personally, because, as you say, they've been interviewed so many times in the past. So Johnny Unitas's recollections of this game have been written about and analyzed and pored over for a half century, whereas somebody like Al Berry, who played offensive line for the New York Giants, I doubt that, you know, more than two or three people have ever interviewed Al at any length about his memories of the game. So he was more valuable, frankly, to me.
One person that I wish you had come along soon enough to interview would be Alan Ameche. And I say that because for the many listeners to this program who are from Kenosha, Wisconsin, they would have, of course, dearly loved to have heard even more about this great running back. Of course, you talk about him in the pages of your book, and he is one very colorful character indeed in this drama.
Well, he is, and he, you know, a great lover of opera, which was a sort of an unusual taste for a football player, a really bright guy who, in addition to his athletic ability, proved to be an extraordinarily astute businessman and investor who made millions when he left football. I think one of the revelations in this book about Alan Ameche, which I've never seen reported anywhere else, is how disgruntled he was playing for Weeb Eubank, his head coach. Eubank, who used a method of motivation for some players who he didn't particularly like, which he called needling, began needling poor Alan Ameche right after he joined the football team. And Ameche cut his career fairly short. He only played for 6 years, even though he was a tremendous success in pro football, and a lot of people have wondered why he bowed out quite so early, and one of the reasons was that he did not like playing for Weeb Eubank, and of course at the time it wasn't very easy for players to change teams.
Let's talk about 1958 and what made this such an important time for the game of football. You say in 1958, professional football, the league and its audience, were on the cusp of an explosion. Tell us the state of affairs leading up to 1958. What was professional football like in this era, and how was it perceived, so we can better understand then the catalyst of change that this game in 1958 proved to be?
Well, of course, pro football had been around for about 30 years and had been growing in popularity throughout the 20th century. It was really the advent of television and the sort of merger of television and football, which occurred most dramatically in this game, that launched pro football. But basically, prior to the sort of the boom years of the 1950s, baseball was the only really major sport in America. It was the national pastime, and it really dominated the leisure time and interests of the American people. But as the wealth of our society grew and people had more and more leisure time, there was a great deal of interest, growing interest in sports as both a recreational activity and as something to watch. And this, of course, this growth in leisure time and interest in sports was happening at the same time that television was maturing and every household in America was getting a television set. So what was about to happen was the sort of explosion, not just of football, but of really sports in general. I mean, you have the creation of professional hockey leagues and basketball, and of course today, you know, there's many more sports that occupy America's interest. Of all these, football is the most successful and is the one that has best exploited television, and I think it's because football is an ideal sport for a television broadcast.
I would like you to explain that just a little bit further. You talk about the game's inherent appeal and what you call its neat fit with TV, and that you put those two things together and pro football and the public were just bound to fall in love with one another. And, of course, 1958 is the moment that happens. Just explain for a moment why football is such a perfect fit with television. What is it exactly about the game?
Well, George Will sort of famously and disparagingly described football as combining two of the worst aspects of American culture, violence and punctuated by committee meetings. And that is true. But the reason that those things are so popular in America is because they're fascinating. You know, football game takes place on a big field, but before every play, all of the players huddle. They decide what they're going to do next, which builds suspense. And then they all line up in a very compact formation, which fits fairly neatly within the binds of a television set. And on the snap of the ball, they execute this play, which takes place over, you know, rapidly, very fast. There are a lot of players, and 22 players in motion. And frankly, it's pretty difficult for someone sitting in the stands of a football game to fully understand what has just happened on any given play. With football, because there's this delay between plays, it gives television nowadays, especially with the tools of slow motion replay and isolated cameras, and of course the commentary of expert football watchers, in the period between plays, you know, we basically what happens is television sorts out the action for us. It isolates the key players. Sometimes nowadays, the analysts will actually draw up on a telestrator on your screen exactly what routes players ran. So the game, as the game is